He was told to grab onto the bed frame and not to count or to scream, otherwise they would start over. And this is where he would be whipped with a leather strap just over and over again.
This is not a reform school. It's a torture chamber.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past 2 decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun, dun, dun.
What is up? Are we recording?
Yes.
What is up, crime crew? Welcome to Murder Unscripted, episode number 73. We've only been doing this, 73 weeks?
Seriously.
You'd think we'd have it down by now.
But you know what, though? If you know us, you'd know we wouldn't. So.
Oh, God, no. Blackwood was tighter than this.
Oh, my God, for real. We were better behaved then.
We were. It's off the rails now.
It is.
I'm your host, 23-year true crime veteran Ed Hydock, along with the caramel to my apple, Melissa Spivey.
That is the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
Well, you know it's spooky season, so I'm going to be absolutely hammering these Halloween similes for the entire month, so I hope you're ready.
Oh, I'm ready. Bring it. So we are in week 2 of our Halloween block entitled Cursed by the Past, and for last week's episode and this week's episode, we found our case inspiration from a book entitled Haunted Crime Scenes by the magical and glorious patron saint of Murder Unscripted, Ms. Catherine Ramsland. And if you missed the announcement, Catherine is actually going to be our featured guest this month. And that interview is going to air the last Tuesday of October, so you definitely don't want to miss it.
I know that she just hijacked the number one rating on HBO Max with The Serial Killer's Apprentice, but I'm confident in saying that the highlight of Catherine Ramsland's career will be Murder Unscripted guest.
Obviously. She's been working towards this her whole life.
Right. And I think we'll give her the platform she's always wanted.
Yeah, this is really good of us.
This is totally a favor she's doing for us.
Oh my God, and we owe her our lives for it.
Big time.
To be fair, I'm going to fangirl out like crazy. It'll be great.
I know. And I'm just going to sit back and watch. I'm going to like have laryngitis that day and make you do the entire interview.
Okay, I'm going to need my inhaler. You're going to
be all red and sweaty.
Oh, absolutely.
So when we were going through cases that Catherine Ramsland had written about or worked on, we came across a story that we'll be covering today. And before I kick this over to Melissa, today we're going to be talking about some child crimes and some pretty horrific situations. There's some dark truths that are going to come up about America's past, the country, things that were accepted at one point in time, and things that people turned a blind eye to. If that isn't for you, just feel free to go back to scrolling and find some cat videos or people slipping on ice. That's what I would do.
We love those videos.
The best.
But when we launched Murder Unscripted, we knew as a podcast that we're never going to make everyone happy, but this is really something that a lot of love and care goes into, from what cases we pick to what sources we use for research and just trying to best tell these stories to ultimately honor the victims, which is exactly what we're going to do today with taking a look into the absolute stomach churning history of the Dozier School for Boys in Marianna, Florida. And as we're learning, as we research from this month's stories, there are a lot of properties that, under the guise of a pleasant name like Villas by the Sea, aka where the Toddville Murder Mansion stood.
Yeah.
These properties have some really problematic histories that should be brought to light. Back to Dozier, and actually that wasn't its original name. When it opened on January 1st, 1900, it was known as the Florida State Reform School. And it sat on 1,400 acres in Marianna, Florida, which is like up in the northeastern portion of the Florida Panhandle. Okay. And the school was originally opened as a juvenile reform school designed to rehabilitate boys ages 6 years old to 21 years old.
6 years old. You can still be like taught the right way by your parents.
Yeah, that seems strange. But
wow.
Well, originally, young boys could actually be sent here by their parents, but primarily a judge or the sheriff as punishment for things like super simple things too, like truancy, trespassing, minor criminal offenses, smoking cigarettes.
What?
Which I thought everybody did prior to like 1980.
How else do you be cool? I mean,
yeah, exactly. Jeez.
Duh.
It was like they were being labeled as incorrigible.
I know a ton of people that fit into the incorrigible category, and I'm talking to one right now.
Fair. Fair enough.
Just saying.
Well, this reform school, it was actually also completely segregated from when it opened in 1900 until 1967. And I don't think the property was necessarily like split in half, but by almost every account that we've come across while researching, and these are from, you know, these now older gentlemen who are survivors of the Dozier School, they would talk about how the white boys and the black boys were kept completely separate in every way possible, except maybe during punishment time.
Wow. It's like a unification, but not the way you want to be.
No, right? Well, we're going to have to go back about 125 years here. And yes, the records were kept, but with everything we're going to find out, I am incredibly skeptical at best of their accuracy. So Sue and I decided to ask our trusty pal ChatGPT to kind of create a timeline based on those records. So by 1903, the first death of they called them students. I kind of want to say prisoner, but...
Yeah, I think that term's used pretty loosely.
Yeah, exactly. Well, by 1903, the first death of a student was recorded, and the listed cause of death was due to illness. I'm like, was it though?
Yeah.
And there were several other deaths recorded between 1903 and 1907. And again, these were all listed as deaths from illness, such as tuberculosis, influenza, and pneumonia. Those are just a couple of them.
It's kind of like when, do you remember when COVID, we were in the height of COVID and people would fall down the stairs and die, but if they had COVID, that would be ruled a COVID death. It's kind of like, it
kinda,
feels like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when this place opened, the living conditions were rough, to say the least, because honestly, the state of Florida basically used these boys as like free slave labor to build all the buildings and facilities that ultimately ended up being on the property. So it was like they had to build their own quarters and everything.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I feel like a lot of these boys, the only air quotes crime they committed was being poor.
Yeah, in this case, that's true.
And I think this is a good place to mention that one of the founders and like one of the architects, I guess, of this place, he was the grandson or maybe great grandson of a slave owner. So he took a page from that horrible playbook to kind of set up a system of air quotes, free human labor for profit.
God, I know these were different times that we're talking about, but damn, the thought of this.
I just can't imagine some of the things that humans have done to humans or still do to humans. It's just mind-boggling.
These people still exist. There are people that would love a world like we're talking about today.
Ugh, that's gross.
It is gross.
Well, that's depressing, as was doing the research for this place. It really was like a downer. So I am going to have to hit you with some pretty rough details, and then we're going to work through some more awful details, but with a little bit of happier components. So I apologize now if it kind of feels like we're jumping all over the place, but here we go. So the best way to break the history of Dozier is really into three categories. We have the intention, the White House Boys, and the Lost Boys. So I'm going to start with the intention. Florida in the early 1900s was nothing like we think of Florida today. And while the population of the state almost doubled from 1900 to 1920, growing from just 500,000 to just under a million people, the state was one of the least populated southern states, and it was incredibly rural. And most people lived in small towns and farming communities. So Florida 100 years ago was definitely not the home of Mickey Mouse. Like, life was hard there for those Floridians. And the state was filled with like wetlands, and they were almost uninhabitable. And the road systems, if there even were any in these towns, were horrific.
Oh, I'm sure they sucked.
It was awful. And in Jackson County, like where we're talking about, the area was heavily agricultural and much less developed than like southern parts of Florida.
Okay.
the roads were pretty much dirt tracks and they could be washed out and impassable, like in just a rainstorm.
And man, Florida gets plenty of rain.
True. So industry then was tied to cotton, peanuts, corn, small scale cattle farming, and timber cutting, or like the logging field, was the primary source of jobs. Poverty was widespread, with many families just stuck in a cycle of debt as sharecroppers or tenant farmers. And because of this, many families, both Black and white, relied on sending their children to work, so education was incredibly limited at best. And I would be doing a disservice if I didn't mention just how ingrained segregation was just as part of the cultural norm during that time.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Jim Crow laws were pretty much like dominated almost every aspect of daily life in Florida back then. And it's wild because in the big picture of Earth, 100 years is a fleck on the fingernail of time. I mean, it's really not that long ago. But at the same time, all the things we're talking about feel like a lifetime ago in our minds just because of how different everything is now.
Yes, it feels so long ago. Mm-hmm. But then when you look at it or think about it, it's really not that long ago.
Right.
So these people, I mean, we're talking, when I say poverty, like they were living in these homes that were basic wooden frames without indoor plumbing or electricity. I would die. A Florida summer with no air conditioning, I would be begged to be taken out by like yellow fever or malaria. That was still going on then. And I would...
You were sweating in the treehouse last night and it was 65 and a gentle breeze. But it couldn't have been nicer last night. You're slapping bugs and sweating.
Okay, the bugs were all over me because I'm so sweet.
I didn't have any citronella.
Exactly. Well, thankfully I survived our treehouse meeting session, but...
You made it. You pulled
through. All of this is to say, these Floridians really spent their days truly just trying to survive. They kind of accepted that the rule of law was widely what we consider frontier justice, meaning that many times the sheriff was the judge, jury, and executioner, like all wrapped into one.
Wow.
Yeah. So when the progressive idea of reform schools started to spread, no one really had the energy or means to do anything about it.
Yeah. Yeah. What are you going to do when one guy's in charge of everything?
Exactly. You can't really fight that. So, like I said earlier, the local sheriff or judge, whoever, they would sentence young boys. I mean, that's what they were. They were young boys sentenced to this reform school. And the intention behind these sentences was to provide educational and vocational training to poverty-stricken youth so that when they completed their sentence, they would return to their lives with some skill sets to help them be better members of society.
Which in theory sounds fantastic, but the methods they use to get there are what's not okay. Like that idea seems awesome. But we also have to remember that people were much more accepting of harsh treatment back then. We're not just talking like this stuff's okay.
Right. And I mean, let's be real. Like when it's all said and done, the people who were in charge of Dozier during its entire history simply saw anyone in poverty as like completely disposable and they didn't care how they treated them.
Right.
Now I'm going to jump into like the 1950s through the 1960s and talk about Dozier's history as what is generally referred to as the White House Boys time or the White House Boys era.
Okay.
So in 2009, Roger Dean Kaiser published a book called The White House Boys, An American Tragedy. And this recalled his time spent at Dozier. Like he actually was there. His book brought together men that survived this brutal torture that they faced while living at Dozier in the 50s and 60s. And the reason they called themselves the White House Boys is because some of the most horrific abuse that they faced happened in this small cinder block building on the campus, which was built by the boys that had been there before them back in 1929.
I'm glad you clarified that because I'm sitting here thinking, like, where does the nation's capital come into this?
Yeah. No, wrong White House.
Yeah.
Well, this is where I got to go into, unfortunately, a little bit of graphic detail. So skip ahead a few minutes if you get where I'm going with that and you don't want to hear it. So this building, I guess in some twisted ways, was supposed to have enough rumors or like folklore about it that it was supposed to deter boys from breaking the rules. Like they didn't want them talking back to a teacher or guard or starting a fight or trying to escape the program, getting a bad grade.
It's like the reform school here. How many times were both? You mentioned it last night that you were threatened too by your parents for you go to the bad kid school. Like,
yep, all the right time. Around the
20 minutes from here, there's a, not, it's a reform school, but it's not anything like this, but there were threats and it was a deterrent for sure.
The bad boy school.
Yep.
I mean, they would even get in trouble for like not working fast enough, just all sorts of things. But as survivors have come forward to share their stories, it is very clear that the White House, more times than not, was treated as like a welcoming tradition at Dozier. So Dozier survivor Robert Strally shares his story. And in 1963, right after his 13th birthday, he can't recall ever going in front of a judge, but suddenly he found himself being put into a van and just taken to Dozier.
God, like he was abducted.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
Wow.
He said that apparently his dad was a long distance trucker who would be away from home for, you know, long periods of time. And unfortunately, his mom was bipolar and struggled at the time to manage her condition and to raise a teenage boy pretty much on her own. And it kind of led him to feel like she just wanted to get rid of him, which is so sad for a child to feel like that.
I don't think there's anything worse a child can hear than "I don't want you."
I don't get it. Well, because of his home life, Robert would run away a lot, which I kind of get it, you know, just to try to get a break from everything. But this is actually what landed him at Dozier for 11 months.
Wow.
So when he got there, like when the van first drove onto the property, Robert was kind of excited. He said the property was beautiful with these big red brick buildings that had these gorgeous flower beds and well-manicured hedges, and he was like, oh my god, this is like camp. Like, I'm gonna have so much fun.
Well, if true crime has taught us nothing else, it's that places aren't what they seem in the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Well, on his first night at Dozier, Robert was pulled from his dorm, and he was taken to the White House. And this is on his first night. He's taken to the White House to be toughened up a bit. So apparently, he was lined up with four or five other boys in one part of the building. And then they were taken into separate rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And in there is where he saw like this broken metal bed frame with a dirty, blood-stained, like thin mattress and a disgustingly filthy pillow. He was told to grab onto the bed frame and not to count or to scream. Otherwise, they would start over. And this is where he would be whipped with a leather strap just over and over again. Robert would also share that one guard in particular was, air quotes, skilled with the leather strap, that instead of hitting them with the width of the strap, he could turn it so the strap came down on the side and would like slice into the young boy's skin.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I actually worked on a farm when I was younger for this racist old farmer back in the day. I was probably 14 years old, and this is called busting the hide. But like, that's what he would call it. But busting the hide is also like, it's a term that I'd always known as like preparing a hide, like stretching it, tanning it. You're busting it. You're softening it up. That's
right.
Breaking the hide. But in the farming community, it's kind of meant to be like a way to get some extra control over animals.
Ugh.
It's cruel regardless, but to think about it in a way that's being used on a human being, I mean, wow.
It makes my stomach hurt. Like, it makes me physically ill to have like to talk about this.
Yeah.
Well, Robert remembers three trips to the White House during his time at Dozier, but the worst case of abuse he faced was when he was taken to the cellar under one of the dorms in what was called the rape room.
Oh my God.
Where he remembers grown men taking turns brutalizing him. And he said he can remember his bones cracking, and he said, quote, "They became men like demons, and then they went home and hugged their grandchildren and went to church on Sunday," end quote.
Perverts don't wear signs.
We say it every week. So we have another survivor. His name is Buddy Somnitz, and he has spoken publicly saying, quote, "Escaping was like trying to kill yourself. Only a fool would have run," end quote. He was sent to Dozier right after his 14th birthday, and it was just about a week after his arrival that he received his first beating in the White House. And he also said, quote, "Those people lost that part of them that had been human. I was either going to get beaten to death or I was going to run and they were going to shoot me," end quote.
It's a no-win situation.
Right. And Buddy did actually try to escape. It was like the darkest night he could wait for. And he recalls the adrenaline just coursing through him that he felt like he could have run so fast. Even if he was running through like a field of landmines, he would have made it. And after about an hour of running, he heard the guards catching up to him and they just started shooting.
It's like a horror movie.
Isn't that awful? Well, they eventually caught up with him and the beating he received was so bad that it actually permanently injured his pancreas.
Oh, like, my
it
God.
Left it with a permanent injury that caused him a lifetime of debilitating pain.
This is not a reform school. It's a torture chamber, is what 100%.
This is absolutely not a reform school. So this is insane, but this school actually was around until 2011, which we'll get to that in a minute. Nope. So in the early 2000s, after the White House boys kind of reunited and were trying to work through the trauma they endured at Dozier, they did try to file a lawsuit against the state of Florida. And Troy Tidwell was known by the boys as the one-armed man.
Let me guess, he had one arm?
Literally, yes. That's why he had one arm.
How creative.
I know, that one sounds a thinker. Well, this guy had been a longtime employee of Dozier, and he was like the only employee from that time period that was left to be questioned about, for legal reasons, I'll have to say, accusations of the White House boys. But he was deposed. And mind you, even with only having one arm, almost all of the boys recalled that he was one of the most brutal and meanest guards at Dozier, with survivors saying, quote, Tidwell lived for those beatings, end quote.
Well, yeah, because you figure if he's got one arm, there's some possibility that he was taking out some kind of rage for only having one arm on these boys.
I can see that, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't imagine people, like, living for beatings. Like, I can't imagine enjoying or getting off on someone else's pain. That's so beyond what my brain can comprehend.
There are people in this world that just crave that stuff, that they would bring back gladiator games if they could. I don't like to see people beating the crap out of each other. It's just not appealing to me.
Yeah, I don't get it. So during this lawsuit, the community was really torn over it because they honestly like couldn't believe that there were such drastic sides to this Troy Tidwell guy. You know, during the day, he's this good neighbor and he went to church and whatever.
Well, everybody feels bad for him because he's got one arm. So naturally in your mind, you feel this guy's a pathetic soul.
Right. But then he goes to this campus and turns into this monster that these boys are describing. That's a lot to try to wrap your mind around.
Yeah.
And during his deposition, Tidwell admitted to spanking the boys as punishment, but he denied any and all other accusations.
Of course he did.
Of course, right? And unfortunately, the judge ruled that too much time had passed, and ultimately the judge dismissed the case.
Did you ever tell any of the boys that if they resisted or turned their head or cried out, you were going to start the beating all over again?
No.
And you never did that?
No.
You're sure of that?
I know that's an answered argument.
Did you ever have any of the boys that when you were through spanking them were bloody from the spanking that they'd received?
I never did even check the boys that I spanked, you know, before I became a supervisor. Well,
you never checked.
I had a chance to see some of the boys that were spanked, and it'd be sometimes a blue spot on their buttocks and pink, you know. Some
never saw any that had that were black from the middle of their back down to the back of their knees. Never saw any boys that had been through a spanking that were black, black and blue, bruised from the middle of their back down
like
to the
I
back
said,
of their
knees. Blue spots on their buttocks.
Yes, sir. You never saw any that were bruised from the middle of their back to the back of their knees?
No.
This reminds me 100% of just Nazi Germany. I mean, SS guards. Mm-hmm. Like, they would actually force male prisoners to stand and applaud while dozens of Jewish women were being sexually assaulted, beaten right in front of them. That's exactly what this reminds me of.
It's disgusting. And again, the fact that it happened really not all that long ago is horrifying.
Yeah, when you said it was there till 2011, I'm hoping that things had changed a little bit from the era we're talking about right now.
Well, as it stands today, in the state of Florida, charges can still be brought up for murder or capital rape, which is the rape of a child 12 or younger. So if a survivor wishes to come forward with the name of their abuser and was younger than 12, the state will move forward. But unfortunately, due to the time that has passed between the stuff that happened at the Dozier School and now, it's really unlikely that anybody's going to get justice through the legal system ever.
Right.
But you have to realize the White House boys filed this lawsuit in 2008 or 2009. And that's what I mean. Dozier was still open operating.
Right.
Yes. Hmm. 2011. That's not that long ago.
It's nuts. 14 years.
Yeah. And there are so many more survivor stories that are similar to Robert and Buddy's, but I did feel like they gave us, you know, a good idea of what was happening there.
Yeah, we get the point, you know?
Yeah. So now it's time to enter some heroes into this horrific episode. We haven't had an MU MVP in a while.
We definitely have not. Do we have one today?
We'll see. We can decide.
Oh, okay.
So Ben Montgomery, he's an investigative journalist, and he caught wind of the Dozier stories like in the early 2000s. And he really started to dig into the history, and he talked to at least 150 survivors. And again, all of them detailed memories of abuse, blood on the walls, being taken for these beatings, being threatened by guards not to tell anyone. And like these guards would be like, I know where you live, so you can't tell anyone. And just all these things that these poor boys had been really keeping as secrets for well over 50 years.
Well, and you can manipulate young minds too. So I'm sure these guards were telling them things like that and they were believing them, whether it was true or not.
Oh, I'm sure. Because why would you think it's not true? I mean,
right.
They're a person of authority. You're supposed to be able to trust them. Clearly you can't.
Exactly. But...
So as Ben's digging into the history of Dozier, he realized that roughly every 10 years or so, a story would break that would cause like major outrage with Floridians, and all these superficial investigations by the state would start, but they never actually led anywhere. So we're talking stories about boys being hogtied, shackled, just straight up going missing. Dozier had become kind of this place of generational employment. Like, I worked there because my dad worked there and my grandfather worked there before him, like that kind of thing. So there was also so much tied up in the politics of it all that it was almost impossible to take Dozier down. And at one point, Dozier had taken on all of the state government's contracting for printing. And it was incredibly profitable when it came to brick making, dairy farming. There were a bunch of repair shops on the campus and even making turpentine. Which,
interesting.
I don't know what's in turpentine, but I can't imagine that it's good for these young children to be breathing in. But okay.
Probably not. No.
Well, thanks to Ben's reporting, Dozier was thrown into the spotlight again. And I wouldn't say that he was the reason it eventually shut down, but I do think his reporting really played a big part in it.
Well, yeah. And I feel like because of the time, what would you say this was, early 2000s?
Mm-hmm.
I think so. I feel like there was the internet almost in every home where like people had access to the internet. So like more people were hearing about the atrocities that happened there. And we know how quickly public outrage can spark change. I think more people getting behind like, oh my God, how awful this is. Once it's out there in the public a little more and people are reacting to it, I feel like there's more pressure to get it shut down.
Right. Because now it becomes like a countrywide problem rather than just Northern Florida's problem or whatever.
Right.
So we have Ben Montgomery as one of our MU MVPs, and another hero, or MU MVP, is Erin Kimmerly, and she's a forensic anthropologist connected to the University of Southern Florida. She had read some of Ben's reporting, and she was shocked she didn't know about Dozier, so she started to look more into it. So with her university backing, she was granted permission in 2012 to do a ground survey of the graveyard, like on the campus. She was going to use the ground penetrating radar to map out these different plots.
It's a funny long story, so don't ask, but I actually priced one of those and they're like $20,000, those radar.
Really?
They are, yeah.
I can't tell you why. Where would you even go to get that? Can you get that off Amazon?
You can get them online. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
That's why I know they're $20,000.
Well, Dozier records stated that there were 31 graves on site, but Erin and her team found evidence that there were way, way, way more than that. In May of 2013, Erin's request to excavate the site was denied. Instead of taking no for an answer, though, this badass lady took her findings public. And again, with the backing of the university, She held a publicly televised DNA collection of family members of the boys that had died at Dozier.
Wait, so back up. You mentioned this was a cemetery. I'm like interested about this graveyard. Like, was it just a mass grave, like unmarked soldiers almost?
So yes, the Dozier property had a graveyard on site, and this is horrible. But the people in charge, if someone died while in their custody, like at Dozier, instead of burying them or returning them to their families or something, they just basically buried them in this mass kind of plot. They all got a PVC pipe cross as a grave marker. They didn't record any names. They didn't record any plots. And they're saying that only 31 boys died in 111 years of this place.
Yeah, okay. Well, at least they could have done with give these kids a proper burial after the way they treated them. But I'm not surprised in the least at all because they weren't treated like humans. They were treated like animals.
Yeah. I mean, that's awful. Well, because of Aaron, our other MU MVP, now I'm going to tell you about the Lost Boys of Dozier.
Did we decide who the MVP was? I know we had two candidates.
We had Aaron and Ben.
I know, but they were just candidates. I thought we had to vote on who was the actual MU MVP.
Both of them? No, I voted both of them. I made the decision.
Congratulations, Aaron and Ben.
Way to go, guys. This is a big deal, just like Catherine being on Murder Unscripted. True. You're welcome. So, like I said at the beginning, some of this is kind of crappy, but at least we have a little bit of good here, too. So, this year on Murder Unscripted, we've covered a lot of older cases that have been solved in, like, the last, 5 to 10 years because of, like, forensic genealogy and genetic genealogy. And we've tried to explain how much painstaking work goes into that. Well, our girl, Erin, is taking it old school. The findings from her GPR survey showed that there were at least over 51 burials. In some reports, I saw over 100.
Wow. I believe that.
Yeah. It's so sad, though. But I mean, yeah, I believe it. But based off the sources that Sue and I had, we'll say 51. And many of these bodies were found outside of Dozier's reported graveyard site.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, so they weren't even where they were supposed to be with the PVC pipe crosses.
Kimberly has traveled the world investigating war crimes for the United Nations, searching for mass graves in places like Yugoslavia and Peru.
Have you done just this area or has all of it?
All of it.
Her team used high-tech equipment to scan into the ground. All the red you see suggests the location of possible grave sites, but we won't know for sure unless exhumations are ordered. Florida state officials won't comment until they can review Kimberly's findings.
These are children who came here and died for one reason or another and quite literally have just been lost in the woods. And it's about restoring dignity and helping, if not putting a name to them, at least marking them and acknowledging that they're here.
So Erin and her team, they were combing through whatever records they can find at Dozier. You know, they're researching and looking for possible family members of the recorded dead or missing boys. And they're getting this DNA and they're excavating these burial sites and just desperately trying to identify the bones to be able to give the boys their names back and, you know, reunite them with their families. Well, hopefully finding some truth behind the deaths of these boys. It can't all be illness.
No, there's no zero chance.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's a big cover-up.
Well, one record that Aaron found was that of Thomas Curry. So in 1925, he was a 17-year-old boy from Philly. And yes, I'm starting with Thomas because he's our Philly bestie from 100 years ago.
Excellent.
And his story is a real bummer. But Thomas, I hope wherever you are, we know your name.
Yeah, go Birds, being from Philly too. And actually, wouldn't have been the Birds. It would have been, I think, in 25, the Frankfurt Yellow Jackets, I think they were back then. But I feel like confident if Thomas were alive today, he'd be in the Bird gang.
Oh, he'd be all over it. He'd be shouting the E-A-G-L-E-S song. Yeah.
You spelled it right. That's.
I had to think about it.
I heard a pause between the G and the. I'm like,
I was like, wait, Eagle, E-E.
I'm in too deep now.
I know. I was like, I got to finish it.
Marty at the G.
L-M-O-P. Well, like I was saying, the records are not great. So we don't know why Thomas from Philly ended up at the Florida Reform School, but he did. And 29 days after he arrived, his death was recorded by Dozier. He wasn't even there a full month.
Nuts.
His records showed that he was killed on a railroad bridge, and his death certificate said wound to forehead and crushed skull. And I'm not totally sure, but I think based off his age, his short amount of time he was there, and other employee interviews that Erin and her team conducted, they thought that Thomas had maybe been killed trying to escape from Dozier.
No, I guarantee it. And I would guess that a lot of these deaths were covered up with less devious language, I guess is the way to put it.
Agreed. And the records also showed that, unlike many of the boys, Thomas's body had been shipped via train back to his grandmother in Philly for a burial, which there is no record of. Erin and her team in Florida worked with all these agencies, like up here in Pennsylvania, to exhume Thomas to be able to examine his body to see if they could figure out more about these head injuries that caused his death. Mm-hmm. Only to find, get this, a very well-preserved wooden casket filled with scrap wood.
Oh my God, he wasn't even in there.
Nope, zero evidence of a body ever being in the casket.
Wow, that's nuts.
So these expats down at the Dozier School sent an empty casket on a long-ass train ride in 1925 from Florida to Philly and told Thomas's grandmother that he was in there. So she paid to bury a box of wood.
It's diabolical.
It's so sad, but like nobody knows where he actually ended up. But to any of like our Philly area or PA tri-state area listeners, if you have any family rumors that sound like you could be a match,
yeah,
reach out to somebody. Reach out to the University of Southern Florida and Erin's team to see about like donating your DNA to see if any of the DNA
for
that
real
you recovered could be Thomas's. That poor kid, like where is he?
Yeah, it's awful to think about.
So the next Dozier boy I want to tell you about is Billy Jackson. And Billy technically can fall into both parts of Dozier history. Possibly one of the White House boys, but he's definitely one of the lost boys of Dozier. Mm-hmm. So he was sent there in 1952 when he was just 13 years old. And less than 2 months later, his family received a letter saying that he had died from a kidney and UTI infection.
You mean the kind you get when you're beaten or severe trauma? Yeah,
exactly. And through records, Erin and her team were able to find Billy's sister Maddie, and they collected a DNA sample from her in hopes of like reuniting Billy with his family. Maddie said that Billy was a wonderful brother. He loved her so much and always looked out for her. Mm-hmm. And she also said that Billy was just a lot of fun and just a joyful person to be around. So after they got that letter, Maddie remembers her mother saying they beat him to death. But as was kind of the time, Billy wasn't talked about a whole lot after he passed. And actually, the mom passed away shortly after they found out about Billy.
And then his memory died with it. If he wasn't talked about much and then she passed, what did Rob Bettner say? The last time you're talked about is when you die.
That's why we keep talking about them. We're still talking about you, Billy.
That's it.
So Erin's team did find a Dozier survivor that knew Billy and most likely was like one of the last people to see him. His name was Woodrow Williams, and he was sent to Dozier in 1952 when he was just 10 years old. Want to know his air quotes crime?
Sure.
He had broken the antenna off of some guy's car and the guy took him to court.
I cannot believe this place was allowed to operate as long as it did. Like, how can anyone in their right mind be willing to turn a blind eye?
You heard. It was all about the money. The government was making good money off the repair shops and the printing and whatever else. It's all about the Benjamins. Remember that song?
I do. And you're spot on.
So the judge asked Woodrow's mother, when Woodrow broke the antenna and the guy took him to court, the judge asked Woodrow's mother if she could pay the $6 to fix the antenna. Yeah. So that way, like, he wouldn't be sent to Dozier. And well, again, just to be clear, $6 in 1952 would be about $75 today in 2025.
Okay.
She couldn't pay it. So Woodrow basically got a year of hard labor and abuse because his family was poor and couldn't afford
it. For a broken car antenna.
I know. Well, Woodrow explained to Erin that not only were they out there doing hard manual farm labor, like they're digging ditches, cleaning cow manure, cleaning silos, they were also basically treated like pack animals. Instead of using a farm animal to plow the fields, the guards would put the plow harnesses on the boys.
On the children. Make, oh my God.
Yes. Making one push and the other pull. Woodrow said that in the days leading up to Billy's death, he was crying a lot and like he just wanted his mom.
I'm sure.
And Billy was talking about running away and he just wanted to get home. And the guards ended up beating Billy so terribly. And the next time Woodrow saw him, Billy showed him his stomach and it was all swollen. And he just kept saying, they beat me.
Yeah.
And Woodrow recalled not wanting to suffer like the same fate. So he just kept his head down, kept doing what he was told, which actually included digging a grave. And at one point while digging this grave, he stopped to think, who am I digging this for?
Right. Could it be yourself?
Exactly. Well, Aaron did ask Woodrow if he remembered going to any funerals while at Dozier. And Woodrow told her, quote, sure, they just dropped him in a hole. We said the benediction and went on our way, end quote.
It's like a task list, just a to-do item.
Sick. So unfortunately, as of this recording, Billy's remains have not been identified or matched.
That's sad, but at least Aaron's work is kind of giving Billy's sister some confirmation about the truth behind her brother's death.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I thought you said there were some happy parts to this. I'm still waiting for those because this is freaking awful.
I know. I'm holding you in suspense.
Hurry up.
And I do have a few more names I want to tell you about. And their stories aren't pleasant, but at least they're reunited with their family.
Okay. Yeah, good. And say their names.
So I want to start with Earl Wilson. In 1944, an older boy in the neighborhood picked Earl up in what he was told was the other kid's uncle's car. So this kid picks him up in the car. He's like, oh, I borrowed my uncle's car. That's going to joyride.
Yeah, let me guess. Not his uncle's.
Ding, ding, ding. It was stolen. So both of the boys were arrested and sent to Dozier. So Earl's younger sister, her name's Cherry, she remembers him as a fairly quiet kid. He was a lot older than her, but he was just always, like, thinking about her, and he would come home with little bags of candy for her. So, like, he's a much older brother, but, like, she's always on his mind, you know?
Yeah, very cool.
And at just 12 years old, and he had only been at Dozier for 72 days, Earl's family received a letter in the mail informing them of Earl's death.
And I'm sure it was, like, something stupid.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure what Earl's family was told about how he died, but it turns out that Earl and eight other boys have been sent to the sweat box,
which is a
7-foot by 10-foot cinder block building on the campus that the boys would be locked in with a bucket of water and a bucket to use as a bathroom for days to weeks at a time, like after they were whipped and beat.
Freaking awful.
It's disgusting. Like, how do people do this to others, especially
to other
children?
Human beings?
Yeah. Apparently the school had a doctor. I'd love to see his credentials. But he had listed the death as blows to the head in official school records.
And finally, somebody calling it like it is, though.
Yeah, it's not doing anything about it. But
no, but at least it's not tuberculosis.
Right. Well, this somehow got leaked to the press. So the school responded by saying that four other boys that were locked in the sweat box with Earl had turned on him and beat him to death. But wait, it gets worse. Those four boys were given life sentences for that.
You're kidding me.
Nope.
How fair is that?
And Earl's death, it's listed as August 31st, 1944. So this poor boy was locked in a cinder block room with no ventilation with eight other boys, basically in Florida in August.
Like, yeah, you're being boiled.
Basically being cooked to death. Yeah, after they had been beaten and whipped. And then the people who did it blame these other four kids who were probably in just as bad a shape as Earl.
I'm sure. It's a convenient excuse.
Yeah, and it avoids any accountability.
Yep.
Well, in 2015, so 71 years after his death, Earl was returned to his sister Cherry, and she was able to bury him next to his two brothers and the rest of their family.
71 years. Like, that is insane. And I'm sure it was a bit of closure, but my God, it doesn't even come close to making up for what he went through.
No, not at all. I feel bad for these families, too. Like, I feel like they didn't have Google, so they couldn't look up reviews of the school when their kids are being sent here by the judge.
No, you're flying blind until someone tells you otherwise.
Yeah, thinking, oh, okay, it's a reform school, things are going to be fine, and clearly they were not.
Clearly.
So I have another boy, Robert Stevens. He was sent to Dozier in 1937, and after 10 months there, he was found dead, stabbed to death.
What's blowing my mind is how quickly these deaths happen after they arrive.
I know. I want to know. I don't think we looked, Sue and I didn't look this up, but how long was the longest person there for?
Yeah, you wonder. And the beatings that they were giving them weren't just little spanks or slaps on the wrist. I mean, every one of these incidents could have been life-threatening. I mean, the way they're being described, especially with these young boys.
Yeah. So
I'm surprised they lived that long if they had to endure this on the daily. Horrific to think about.
Well, back to Robert. So in 2013, Aaron had reached out to a gentleman named Bobby Stevens, asking if he would be willing to donate his DNA, as there was a chance a relative of his may be one of the unidentified Dozier boys. Bobby is completely surprised by this call because he had no idea he had any possible connection to Dozier. Could you imagine getting that phone call out of nowhere?
Yeah, I'd be like, I'm sorry, what?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So Bobby's dad, he had died when Bobby was just 2 years old, and Bobby didn't even realize he had been named after his Uncle Robert, actually.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. In 2015, Erin was able to confirm her team had located Robert, like his remains, and 78 years after his death, Robert Stevens was reinterred with the rest of his family. The Stevens family said that, you know, it does bring some closure to have Robert home, but it also opens up like a whole batch of questions about his death and how could it have happened.
Yeah, I would say so. And I've never gone through this, but I feel like if it were my family, I would want answers. Like, I would want to know exactly how it happened, exactly what my loved one went through so that I could process it and just kind of move on. Like, I would want every little detail so I can absorb it first and then work on healing from it.
Agreed. Yeah. And I mean, how do you heal from something that you didn't even know existed at first? And
that's true, too.
Like, that's just a whole nother layer of trauma.
True.
So another one of the lost Dozier boys that had been reunited with his family was George Owen Smith. Owen had a passion for music, and he had run away with another local boy, and they were trying to make their way to Nashville. He just wanted to go to Nashville and sing.
Yeah,
but
they had a dream.
The police caught up with them and ultimately sent them to Dozier for running away to Nashville. You get sent there.
Ovell Krell's brother was sent here in 1940. She says Owen Smith dreamed of playing guitar at the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville. The 14-year-old had a musician's vagabond soul. Her family was told Owen had run away. She still has a letter sent by the school superintendent more than 70 years ago.
We have been unable to get any information concerning his whereabouts. We will appreciate your notifying us immediately if you receive any word from or concerning him.
But Ovell Smith believes her brother was already dead. A few weeks later, his family was told his decomposed body was found under a house near the school.
They think he crawled under there to try to keep warm and that he got pneumonia and died. And that was their official cause of death, was death from pneumonia and exposure.
But that was that based on anything scientific or any kind of autopsy?
Ovell says another student told them a far different story.
But he looked back, and my brother was running out across a field, an open field, and there was three men shooting at him with rifles. I believe till this day that they shot my brother that night, and I think they probably killed him, and they brought him back to the school and buried him.
Oh my God, like he was being hunted.
Yeah, basically.
He was probably terrified.
I know. So Erin and her team, they're unable to confirm Owen's cause of death, but he was actually their first DNA match, and they were able to return Owen to his younger sister. And after 73 years, she was able to keep her promise to her parents and bring him home and bury him with the mom and dad. So the last of the lost boys of Dozier I want to mention, this is a tough one. In 1934, there were these brothers, 13-year-old Thomas and 15-year-old Hubert. And their last name was Varnado.
Okay.
They were met at their home by the sheriff, who took them away, and he sent them to Dozier for malicious trespassing. Do you want to know what they trespassed on?
I'm actually really interested to know.
You don't, though. So on their way to and from school, they basically cut through the corner of a neighboring property to shorten the distance they had to walk. Like every kid does ever.
In every yard that's ever existed? Yeah.
Exactly. And this is like Great Depression era. And these two boys are trying to cut a quarter mile off their walk to and from school, and they get charged with a crime.
This is a nightmare.
Mm-hmm. Well, 34 days after they got to Dozier, 13-year-old Thomas had died from what the family was told was pneumonia.
Oh, bullshit.
Yeah. And again, remember, there's no undertaker. There's no autopsy. There's no proof his death was recorded accurately. It's whatever they feel like writing down.
Yeah. And you have to take it as gospel, I guess, as the family, because what you don't know what's going on.
Yeah. Well, Hubert ended up surviving his time at Dozier, but they had a younger brother, Richard. He said, quote, "I grew up without Thomas. I did get Hubert back, but he spent the rest of his life being traumatized," end quote. Richard said that Hubert wouldn't talk to anyone about his time at Dozier, like, once he got back. However, he did eventually break down and tell his wife, like, much later in life, some of the things that he went through. Wow. He apparently said that he was forced to dig a hole and put his own brother in the ground.
Good God. Think of something worse. I mean,
you can't. There's nothing. So after 80 years, Richard said it felt like he picked him up from the depths of hell and brought him back to where he belongs. And now 13-year-old Thomas is buried between his mom and dad, so he's safe and where he belongs after all these years.
It's the only solace, I guess. It's like when you hear these cold cases where there's no body and they finally find a body, like, yes, it doesn't bring that person back, but it does give you some level of closure to know that you have them in your possession and you've buried them properly and now you have a place to go grieve, and it's a tangible thing you have now.
Well, I just want to mention one last thing. With remains that Erin and her team have not been able to identify via DNA matches, they've been using this digital software to create forensic composites, and like they're trying to bring these boys' faces to the public in hopes that someone will recognize them as like a family member. Sadly, time is really not on their side in regard to like how the remains are. But I will say Erin and her team, they are continuing to process as much DNA as possible that they can find. And as of 2016, she was trying to work with the state of Florida to find a proper and respectful way to like catalog this data that they do have and kind of come up with a plan for proper burial of these remains in hopes that more families can be reunited.
Well, and look how far DNA technology has come in just the time that we've been alive. Can you imagine what it's going to be in 20 more years? I'm hoping that with more advances, more things like this can be solved, or at least maybe some of these boys will turn up and have names thanks to some new thing we don't even know about yet.
Yeah, we just need more kick-ass people like Erin and Colleen Fitzpatrick and CeCe Moore to do this work.
Truth.
Well, that is most of the Dozier School. I kind of hit a bit of a dead end in regards to where everything stands today. Like, I don't know what plans Florida has for the property, but honestly, I feel like until the whole place has been scanned and any other remains have been removed, I feel like they can't do anything with that land.
Yeah, you're kind of stuck. And this reminds me of that. Remember the mini I did with Devil's Cut? That railroad, the Irish workers, or Duffy's Cut. It was this railroad line that these Irish immigrants were brought in to lay in the Philadelphia area. All those guys in that mass grave that were found that were supposedly dead from tuberculosis. I think it was tuberculosis. Might have been like...
Yes, tuberculosis. I think it was.
But then they dig them up. They do this big excavation using these ground-penetrating radars. Anthropologists come in and they dig these guys up and they find they were actually executed. Some of them had bullet wounds. That's kind of what it reminds me of.
Yes. I was thinking about this whole case. I was thinking about that. Just, you know, they all said, they died of this, that, the other thing. But
what's this giant bullet hole?
Yeah, exactly.
You didn't see this yet, but I brought, when we were talking about haunted crime scenes, I wanted to understand like why bad energy supposedly exists in these places that have such bad stuff attached to them. So I pulled a couple things, and it was interesting because there's psychological explanations for this.
Really?
Well, yeah, because we were talking like, is this real? Is it something made up in people's heads? Like, are ghosts real? Energy, this and that. So one of them is the emotional contagion. So basically saying that emotions are psychologically contagious, meaning people that were in close contact with others can unconsciously mirror and internalize their moods. So in a crime scene, this intense fear of like stress or anger can permeate into the atmosphere almost and kind of influence your emotional state.
Interesting.
Yeah, they also listed intuition and perception. So people are very intuitive about their surroundings and can pick up on unspoken tension. So to me, that just meant like, if you believe that this emotional like residue exists, that it's going to affect your mood and the way you behave. And the other one was confirmation bias. So meaning if a person knows that a crime took place there in your head, you're basically biased to interpret that as a very negative place.
Oh, which 100%. Was kind of
interesting. Yeah. So you get this unease and this like kind of pre-existing belief that the space is negative.
Well, that makes sense. That's kind of like a mind over matter thing.
Totally.
Yeah.
And so then there were some more things that they listed: physiological and environmental cues. So chemo signals. Human emotions produce subtle chemical signals called chemo signals, which are present in sweat and tears. Studies have shown that people exposed to the chemo signals of someone experiencing fear will also show fearful facial expressions. Similarly, chemo signals from someone happy can produce a positive reaction. I mean, I guess that's just saying like you pick up the vibe, you match energy with the people you're around.
That makes sense because they say like dogs' personalities mirror their owners. I feel like it's also like if I yawn, you're gonna yawn. It's just like one of those things you do, like you pick up
my dog yawns. So when my dog yawns, I yawn. So explain that.
You want to be exactly like Gil because he's a handsome Australian gentleman.
Maybe we're exchanging chemo signals.
Maybe.
The other thing listed: sensory input. The brain cognitively processes a variety of sensory inputs, and the physical details of a space can impact a person's mood. This can include unsettling sights, smells, and even the feeling of clutter in a space where a violent event occurred. Makes total sense.
Yes, absolutely.
Cognitive processing. Knowing that a violent or traumatic event occurred in a particular space can trigger a fight or flight response and can cause psychological distress in people indirectly exposed to the trauma. And I think this is what kind of what we just talked about, like crime scene cleaners, death investigators like Shannon, you just PTSD, all the things that they suffer from seeing these things. And then it led to this, it's called the quote-unquote stone tape theory, which suggests that a traumatic event can leave an energetic imprint or an echo on the physical environment that replays over and over and over. And in paranormal belief systems, this residual energy is said to have specific manifestations, including lingering feelings, residual hauntings, temperature shifts, and other sensations like being watched and being paranoid.
Wow. So
that, I don't know if that's a scientific explanation for like why bad vibes exist in these places, but it makes sense to me.
No, that does make total sense. And I do think a lot of it is mind over matter. Like the whole, if you know something bad happened there, I think you're going to be more creeped out than you would be if you didn't know something bad happened.
Yeah, but then there's the belief system. And I know some people that will disagree that they're just legit haunted.
Well, did you know that the house that I grew up in was supposedly haunted?
I did, maybe. I think you mentioned it offhand. I don't know why I never asked you more about it, but I think you mentioned that.
Okay, so my dad bought my mom this house in the 80s, and it was built in 1735. And
wow, that's old.
Yes, very old. And it was 3 stories, old, big old farmhouse. Mm-hmm. And I think that the previous owners had told my mom and dad that it was haunted, but I can remember one of my aunts had a really weird paranormal experience in actually the bedroom that would later become mine.
What was it?
She like woke up and there was this bright light in the room and she felt like this overwhelming sense of like dread, I guess.
Did she leave a lamp on?
That's what I wonder too.
There's this bright light from outside. Is it a street light?
My mom always felt like we had ghosts, but they really loved us, that they were like protective of us.
But like, was you just what we were talking about? Did your mom think that because she was told the house was haunted?
Maybe, yeah. But I do know. Do you know how? So my bedroom was on the 3rd floor And there was a landing right outside of it with some steps. And I can't tell you how many times the dogs would run upstairs with me and they would get to that landing and just stop.
Really?
And like stare into my room and take off the other direction.
So skeevy.
We had two dogs that would do that, Molly and Roxy. They both did that.
You wonder if somebody like fell down the steps back in the 1700s or 1800s and died?
So creepy.
Wow. That is wild.
And I don't know if I should tell this story. We might have to cut it out. I have to check with my mom. But when we went to sell the house, okay, when we went to sell the house, right before each walkthrough or open house, something would happen. One time before a walkthrough, my brother and I were about to leave the house. And all of a sudden from like the entry foyer on the opposite side of the house, we hear this crash. My mom had like decorative plates up on like the mantles kind of. And they had been there for years. One of them fell down and shattered right before a walkthrough. Like we were scrambling to get out of there.
Yeah.
There was another time where I think like the heat went out right before a walkthrough. The electricity went out right before a walkthrough. Like it was just all these things that kept happening. And there was finally one day that my mom just like lost it and she started yelling at the ghost.
Please, like, please don't check with Linda. Does she watch these things? Because just leave.
No, I don't think so.
Perfect.
Well, Linda was so fed up because something else went wrong right before a walkthrough or an open house. And she lost it on the ghosts.
Damn you, ghosts.
And started yelling at them. And she was basically like, we've been here for 30-some years or 20-some years. Like, it is time to let us go.
She's giving them the history.
But wait a second. You know the next walkthrough we had, the people bought the house?
You're kidding. So
swear
maybe the ghost got the hint. The ghosts were like, geez, we don't want any trouble.
All right. We're sorry. Geez.
Damn, Linda.
Yeah. Isn't that wild?
Well, that's our banter this week. And that's a lie. That's a bold-faced lie because I need to mention the yogurt shop murders being solved.
Yes. Oh, my gosh.
We put out a couple posts about this. And my God, we recorded that thing with no knowledge that this thing would be solved in just a couple weeks. When it first happened, I was so skeptical because the timing after the HBO doc was very suspicious. And having one guy, this Robert Eugene Brashers, being tied to it didn't make sense. You got four girls you have to control.
Yeah.
And there's multiple weapons in there. I was certain it was going to be two people, at least two, to kind of do what they did in the yogurt shop. But during that press conference, when they laid out the evidence, his MOs in another state, he had kidnapped and held four young girls. He held them hostage with their own clothing, which is exactly like the yogurt shop. Mm-hmm. He was known to carry multiple weapons at a time, as proven by that same crime scene. So when you hear about how this guy operated, it made total sense. And I was just so freaking pumped to hear this news because the fact that we just covered it, we learned so much about these girls and the story that it was just awesome to hear an actual development in a case that we covered. And something that I have it written down still because I was trying to do a video about it. The last thing that Detective Dan Jackson said before he left the podium was, quote, Amy's final moments were spent solving the case, fighting back, end quote. Aww. She was the one body that was separated from the other girls. There was a cluster of bodies and she was a couple feet away and shot twice because she was crawling for the door. God. And that's why she got shot a second time. So that girl managed to scratch Brashers enough to get his DNA under her fingernails. And 34 years later, she solved this case. Absolutely gives me goosebumps to even talk about.
She's amazing. All of those girls are amazing. And can we talk about who helped solve the case?
Colleen.
My girl, guys. Colleen Fitzpatrick. Dr. Colleen Fitzpatrick.
There is so many updates. So tell our audience, you connected with Colleen. Like this is
guys,
so
I
many
did.
Developments.
This is huge. Reached out to Colleen and messaged her just yesterday or 2 days ago. And she got back to me early this morning. And I literally stopped what I was doing at work and called Ed because I was so excited.
Your voice was quivering.
It
was like you won the lottery.
So excited. Like, I don't need Madonna. I don't need any of them. I need Colleen. Like, that's who I need.
But what kills me is the way that you connected with her is like you just messaged her and you wasn't professional in the least. You were just like, oh, my God, Colleen, I am such a fangirl. Oh, my God, your work.
I was so unprofessional. I told her that instead, like how people call themselves Swifties if they like Taylor Swift, I call myself a Fitzy because of her.
You laid it on thick.
I told her what a fangirl I was. I totally geeked out, and I don't care because she needs. I didn't tell her that I love her, so that's good. I wanted to, but I deleted
and
that.
And she
part.
Wrote back. Yeah, don't be. There's a fine line between stalker and just so. I would. You're towing it right now. Well, that is it, guys. That's the Dozier School and some bonus material and some information on why crime scenes might be haunted. If you're less of a believer in the paranormal and more believer in science, you can decide what you think leads to these kind of spooky encounters and things that happen at bad scenes.
Yep. And we have one more case coming at you next week. And this is definitely a haunted, not just property, but we got like a haunted town.
Yes.
Coming up on our next case. So stay tuned for that next week. And just a quick reminder to please like, subscribe, follow, rate, review, all the things. I know it's annoying. Every podcast asks you to do this, but it really, really does help.
Yeah, very much so.
Also, Ed and I had a planning meeting last night in the treehouse, like we mentioned.
Yeah, we did.
And we've already announced we're going to be starting our Patreon in January. But actually, last night, we came up with some really cool stuff, some really cool tiers, some really cool ideas. I know I'm super looking forward to that. And if you guys have any suggestions for either Patreon tiers or even for cases you want to hear, please feel free to send them our way. We really kind of want to get a backlog started. So that way, anyone who wants to join right away, you have a couple things to listen to.
And straight up, we don't have to talk about a crime case. If you want to learn more about the TV industry, or this is your chance to connect with us on a personal level and know more about maybe what you would hear on the show normally. So holler.
Yeah, let us know. And you know where to find us. Our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com. You can get us on our socials at Murder Unscripted, or you can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. And you know you can, of course, reach us on our Reddit, because me, Ed, and our girl Shannon, who you guys heard from 2 weeks ago, the three of us are on there, and we love interacting on the Reddit platform. So be cool. Peer pressure. Come join us.
Everybody's doing it.
Yeah, all the cool kids.
It's like smoking cigs.
No, that's not cool.
In the 50s it was.
And remember, don't do it. I don't care about your health. I care about you getting caught for a crime. You could get framed.
That's true.
Well, that is all we have for you. So until next week, stay safe, stay hydrated.
Yep.
And remember, perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
Every single one of those guards that worked at that school is a certified pervert.
The worst kind of pervert. Bye. Yep.